On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we talk about Baseball Hall of Fame. Handful of players will have the opportunity to be inducted into the Hall of Fame this weekend via the Veterans Committee. What does that mean? Who are those players? Who will be voting on it? We get into all of that, and we welcome a very special guest. It's Lucas Giolito, our pal and Major League Baseball pitcher, currently a free agent. What does it mean to be a Major League free agent? What is that experience like? How does Lucas think his 2025 went, and what does he hope for in the years to come? We have some signings to review, and then even on this Thursday, we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbecast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbecast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks the Hall of Fame should just be one person. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and it should just be the most famous player. And if you're not... Because, like, what I'm saying is, if you're not the top dog, if you ain't first, you're last, right?
But it's at any given time. You're basically saying whoever is the most famous baseball person, dead or alive, I guess, at any given moment, that person should be the sole member. Yep. I kind of like that. I do think that there could be some sort of designation in the Hall of Fame. Maybe they're not the only person allowed, but I do like that if we really leaned into the fame element, I kind of like that. And Otani would probably have it covered for quite some time.
On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we are going to talk about the Hall of Fame. We have the Veterans Committee ballot. And the upshot here is that a bunch of really, really good players that you probably saw play have a chance to get in the Hall of Fame. We're not talking about, you know, Seven Finger Johnson and Twinkle Toes McGillicuddy. Like, this is Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Jeff Kent, Don Mattingly. Okay.
Yes.
You saw them play on television. And if you did not, your parents most certainly did. We'll do that. We'll do Lucas Giolito. Probably not a Hall of Famer.
Ooh, I don't know, man. He was talking about, you know, you're going to hear our conversation with our pal Lucas Giolito making his triumphant return to our podcast for the first time in about a half decade. We've known Lucas for a long time. He is, of course, a free agent right now. You're going to hear our conversation with him in the second block of this pod. And he was talking about how excited he is for kind of this second prime of his career. A lot of work to do, for sure, to kind of get in the mix for Cooperstown. I think even he would admit that. But I'm excited for the next chapter of Lucas. I don't want to rule him out just yet. Let's at least maybe give him a chance to get on the ballot someday.
Totally agree. We had a great conversation with him. The first question I asked him was, where are you going to sign? So make sure you continue listening to find out what he said to me. And then at the end of the episode, we'll go around the league and do a version of good, of bad, and of ugly. But let's begin with our opener, the vets.
All right, Jake, let's get into it. Now, the traditional Hall of Fame discussion during the offseason involves the BBWAA ballot, right? The one that is most commonly followed throughout the offseason and is announced at the end of January. The players who get to be on the ballot for up to 10 years and, you know, they get support and voters talk about their ballots and they submit them and Ryan Thibodeau tracks them and publishes them. And we will cover that group of players later on this winter. That's, you know, Carlos Beltran has a good chance to get in. Andrew Jones, maybe. Chase Utley going to make some progress. Felix Hernandez in his second year on the ballot. Certainly one I'm heavily invested in and intrigued as to where he falls. A couple interesting newcomers like Cole Hamels and so forth. But this conversation today is much more pressing because the contemporary era ballot, baseball era ballot, is an opportunity for players who did not get into the Hall of Fame on the writer's ballot to still get inducted. And this is timely because this process occurs at the winter meetings. This is an actual meeting that takes place between a 16-member committee. We'll get to who those people are in a second. They get in the room. I assume it is nicely catered, I would guess. That's part of the Hall of Fame budget goes towards catering this event. These 16 members get in a room before the winter meetings or at the winter meetings, and they discuss all the candidacies for, in this case, we have 8 players. And each of these committee members is allowed to vote for up to 3 people on this ballot. And if any of these players on the ballot, and we'll get to those players in a second, gets the same 75% that is required on the writer's ballot, so in this case, that's 12 of 16 votes, as opposed to however many hundreds of the BBWA ballot that are necessary, then you're in the Hall of Fame, all the same, right? How you get in, most times people aren't going to remember exactly how you got in, right? You know, we've seen over the past 10 years or so, a lot of players get into the Hall of Fame, whether it's Fred McGriff, whether it's Dick Allen and Dave Parker last year, whether it's Ted Simmons, Tony Oliva, Harold Baines. This is how he eventually got in. Lee Smith gets in, Jack Morris, Alan Trammell. Like, they're Hall of Famers the same way that Willie Mays is and all the other guys that get in on the writers. But this is a process. This is kind of the second opportunity for these players.
And it's this a backdoor. And yes. It is, in a way, I would imagine, was established as an opportunity to right historical wrongs, mm-hmm. to create an avenue for mm-hmm. players to get a second chance. You know, time passes and players, our perceptions of them change, their importance to the history of the game, the quality of their production. You know, time reveals significant things. However, as it pertains to this year's version of the ballot, it is these are all contemporary players. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this octet of former sportsmen are Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Carlos Delgado, Jeff Kent, Don Mattingly, Dale Murphy, Gary Sheffield, and Fernando Valenzuela.
And I think you kind of talk about how this is an opportunity to right a historical wrong. It's also an opportunity for a different group of people who are considered qualified to talk about these players and to consider their candidacies.
If not more qualified.
If not more qualified. It's certainly in the eyes of players, right?
I love being in the BBWAA. Yeah. I would say that the average member of this 16-person committee, mm-hmm. who you will explain who's on it in a second, mm-hmm. is more qualified than the average BBWAA member.
Which is what makes this interesting. And you can imagine, I'm sure that for the players that have gotten in off of these committees, there's probably a sense of pride in some respect that that's how they got in. Not that, you know, the Pedro Martinez's and Randy Johnson's of the world are like, man, all the writers voted me in instead of my friends, you know, my peers. It's whatever. You're once you're a Hall of Famer, you're not worried about it. So who are those 16 people? Because that's not
who'll
a lot
be
of people.
Voting?
That's
who'll
not
be
a lot of people. Okay. So the way that they split it up, this committee, is basically three categories of people. It's Hall of Fame players, you know, living Hall of Fame players who are still, I guess, involved in Hall of Fame activities. So these are players who have already been in, whether they got in via the writer's ballot or whether they got in on one of these committees. Alan Trammell is a good example of that. Executives, which also includes owners. So these are people that have been general managers or POBOs before we were calling them POBOs, or just part of ownership groups is another part. And then there is also a kind of media historian component, but that's the smallest group, right? So that's still represented in this committee, but it is the smallest group. So I will read you those names for this year. This year, the committee consists of 7 Hall of Fame players. That's Fergie Jenkins, that's Jim Cott, that's Juan Marichal, that's Tony Perez, that's Ozzie Smith, Alan Trammell, and Robin Yount. The 6 executives/owners include Mark Attanasio, Doug Melvin, Artie Moreno, Kim Ang, Tony Regans, and Terry Ryan. Our 3 media members include longtime historian Steve Hurt, Tyler Kepner, friend of the show, and Jason Stark, another friend of the show. So 2 very familiar faces there who will be included.
I didn't get on it.
No, Jake was not invited. Maybe in 50 years.
Voter suppression.
Now, the quick note on this electorate, Alan Trammell, Kim Ang, Artie Moreno, and Steve Hurt, those 4 of the 16 were also on it, this committee, 3 years ago when the committee elected Fred McGriff, I believe unanimously. Actually, which is interesting. But that's also important because 4 of the players who were on the ballot this year, this group, were on that committee, were on that ballot 3 years ago. That's Dale Murphy, who only got 6 votes. That's Don Mattingly, who got 8 votes, the most of that group, but did not get in. And that is Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens. So this is not the first time that Bonds and Clemens have been on one of these committees. And last time, they didn't even get 4 votes. We don't know exactly how many votes they got, whether they got 0, 1, 2, or 3. But in the press release, they said they got fewer than 4 votes. Now, that is an important detail because the Hall of Fame also introduced a rule recently that if you don't get at least 5 votes multiple times, you don't get on this ballot anymore. And there's a separate committee that decides who gets to be on this ballot in the first place. But the point is, that's a big deal. If Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens do not get at least 5 votes here, we're not talking about them really ever again in a Hall of Fame context unless something drastic changes. That's a significant thing, okay? And also, yeah, potentially a likely outcome based on how we could maybe infer that this group might vote. But again, there are 12 new members, so who's to say?
You can basically break this group of players down into 8, this group of 8 into 3 groups in my mind. There's the dudes who, if they never did the juice, would be in the blink of an eye. And that is Bonds, that is Clemens, and that's Gary Sheffield, where the numbers are overwhelming enough that if they never did the roids, they're Hall of Famers. Then you have the underrated guys that history does not or has not celebrated enough in some people's eyes. That is Delgado, that is Jeff Kent, that is Dale Murphy. And then you have the culturally vital to the story of the sport, but the numbers are probably a tick below on a career level what you would expect from a Hall of Famer. That is Fernando Valenzuela, and that is Don Mattingly. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good way to kind of segment these people. And I will say, because there are so many qualified candidates on this list, I would be floored and shocked if Bonds and or Clemens got in right now, because you are only allowed to vote for 3 people. Mm-hmm. And it is difficult for me to envision Bonds and Clemens being on enough lists with that in mind. Now, I would say for a certain part of the electorate, right, like they're probably either all in or all out on the steroid guys, right? And that's what makes it tough. Like if I was voting and you said, Jake, you can just, you're baseball god, you can just like roller coaster tycoon, pick these people up and just drop them in Cooperstown. Like who would you pick, right? I would do Bonds, Clemens, Sheffield, Mattingly, and then we could have a long conversation about Carlos Delgado, right?
Okay, interesting. So Mattingly
probably doesn't make it.
But that's also, you're not abiding by the max of 3, because I thought that was kind of the line of thinking you were going by.
I'm in charge.
Sure. Can't stop Jake from picking people up and putting them in Cooperstown, even though they're waiting in line for the most exciting roller coaster in the park.
Yeah.
I think that that's interesting. I think that it does create a dynamic where right, like maybe there's someone on this ballot that's like, or on this committee that's like, this isn't close. Bonds, Clemens, and Sheffield have far and away superior numbers to these other people, so why are we wasting our time? But we know that that's not how this is going to work, and that's what makes the dynamic of this different than every individual BBWA voter kind of coming to a conclusion on their own. There is clearly going to be other dynamics involved here in a very private, confidential setting. We don't know exactly who voted for who. They will tell us how many votes each player got. But that's what's interesting here. So I agree. So let's talk about what we think, who we think could get in, right? We do have the data point of Don Mattingly having got 8 votes last time. Now, again, it's a different group this time. I don't know if there's some sort of similar effect to where we see on the writer's ballot, where after multiple years of consideration, guys maybe get another boost and you consider, okay, we've made him wait long enough. And this is after Don Mattingly was on the writer's ballot for 15 years and never got remotely close to the 75%. But I don't know, like the difference between 8 and 12 is a lot. like that's a big jump when we're talking about this tiny sample of people. Dale Murphy, the other one, having got 6 votes last time. I don't know. I think it's very, very possible we end up with nobody here. But I also wouldn't. I think Mattingly and Murphy are the ones I'm thinking as most plausible. But it's really hard to read. It's really, really hard to read.
So you said that they like discuss this.
Yeah.
Like they get in a room and they like talk it out.
Yeah. Now, have to vote individually.
Sure.
But that's my understanding. That. Jason Stark wrote about this process, which he's a part of at The Athletic. So you can kind of get a sense for that.
First thought, that's a podcast, guys.
Like what a pod that would be.
Like put the mics on, yo. Like you're in there making
I'll say this on behalf of our producer. Nightmare to produce.
Nightmare to produce, people. But worth it. Worth it. Worth it?
Great. Well,
I would pay money for that. Are you kidding me? Big coin.
To hear what the Hall. But this is the other interesting, because we can't ignore that this is not accusing them of any sort of corruption, but like, this is just human dynamics. I mean, think about this, right? These are the other Hall of Famers who are already in.
Well, so this is why I think they will vote someone in. Okay. I don't know who,
so but it is different. They will. Okay.
I think if they all just submitted a ballot via Telegram or Morse code or text or whatever, no one would get in. But I think the human dynamic of everyone being in a room and like arguing, names will certainly rise up. Like Fred McGriff being unanimous last time, do you really think he would have been unanimous if they didn't talk about it beforehand? No chance. So I think they're going to get in that room and they're going to get on the same page about somebody. And I think it's going to be Don Mattingly. And I think he's going to be a Hall of Famer, because that's just, I don't think those people want to leave that room having not put someone in. Because if you're on the committee and you don't put anybody in the Hall of Fame, you're almost like invalidating the purpose of the committee, at least publicly. Now, in my eyes, it's like saying no is part of why this is important. But I just think that they're going to want to say yes, right? People want to say yes.
That point I agree with. I don't think it I don't think that they should feel pressure to do it, because I could also argue the opposite, which is that if you're a Hall of Famer, you're like, this is special. You better really impress me. You know, you better, like, why would I want this to be something easy to get into? No, we can't just be letting more and more people in. I do think that that's why this is worth talking about, because even though we aren't going to really have the full insight as to how this goes down, I think that there are so many social dynamics. I mean, just think about the people involved. All of these people, a lot of these people, and whether they, this is not accusing anybody of anything. It's just the facts, right? Some of these players played against some of these other players. Some of these players were teammates with some of these other players. Some of these owners, GMs acquired some of them. Like, again, I'm not going to go through the specifics, but like, that's just the nature when you have people who have been in the game for this long. And that's not even including whatever relationships they have had, positive or negative, in the years since their playing days. Because, these are just accomplished baseball players that exist in all these different baseball circles. That's the part where it's like really hard to reckon with the really personal dynamics at play. I know some people don't even really ultimately care that much, but I'm compelled by it, especially now that we are talking about players that. Now, a lot of these players, of course, we don't remember watching that much, but it's there as much as the guys that are, you know, joining the ballot on the writer's ballot now, because their careers actually mean something to us. But these are players that we at least have some semblance of opinion about. And so it is kind of fun. I guess that would be my last point before we send it to our conversation with Lucas. Is there one player on this ballot? I think I agree with you about Mattingly, but we've spent enough time over the years talking about Bonds and Clemens, so we won't even bother. But the one that compels me is Delgado. Not that I think he's going to get in or even maybe get the 5 votes necessary to maybe be on a future one, but it's a very simple one. Like, he's, I believe, 34th all time in home runs. And if you look at everybody that's ahead of him,
they're all in the Hall or roided up.
Or will be in the Hall, right? There's 33 guys ahead of him. Only 9 of them are not in the Hall of Fame. That's 7 guys connected to PEDs. And then Albert Pujols and Miguel Cabrera, who will be in the next couple of years. So again, it's not that simple. You can't just look at the homers. And Delgado's an interesting one too, because what he lacks is whatever. It's 2 All-Star games. It's barely no 1 trip to the postseason. He does not have the accolades whatsoever. But his peak was pretty freaking awesome. I mean, his 2000 season is one of the best offensive seasons of the last, 40 years. He's just a beast. So would I vote for him if I don't know, probably not. But it's definitely a career I've enjoyed. I'm glad he's getting some spotlight here in this select group.
The more I look at it, the more I realize Dale Murphy is not in like the underrated career category and is more in the cultural icon whose stats don't quite get their category.
Yeah.
And the more I think about it, that's the type of player I care more about. Like totally. Mattingly, Murphy, Valenzuela, where it's like this guy was important to telling baseball story and mattered to a ton of people. And so if anyone gets in, I hope it's one of that trio. All right. From Hall of Famers to a Hall of Gamer. A man,
nice.
A man addicted to the sticks. A man Well, he's not using sticks. He's playing on PC. We didn't talk too much about gaming with Lucas Giolito, but we did talk about a whole lot else. You'll hear that conversation after the break. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Everybody has that one unemployed friend. And ours is Lucas Giolito. Lucas, no college degree, no LinkedIn profile. Do you have a resume on your computer?
No, man. I'm cooked. I'm cooked.
All right, Lucas, thank you for joining us. Lucas Giolito is admittedly cooked. We are absolutely ecstatic to have you back on the show. Your first appearance on this stupid podcast was way back in April of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
It has been over a decade. We've had you on in the time since. A lot has happened in our lives. A lot has happened in your life. A lot has happened in the world. But the one question I think we need to start with is, what team are you going to sign with, Lucas?
No idea. That's a crazy question to ask. And it hasn't even been winter meetings yet.
All right. Well, I'm glad we're on the same page.
All right.
Cool. Because I also have no idea. And instead of probing any further and trying to get you to reveal any confidential information.
Can you imagine, though? Look, can you imagine if I asked that and you're like, the freaking Reds, dude? Like, yeah.
He's like, I'm so glad you asked. I just found out.
That'd be cool. No, I have no idea. I still don't. I don't know anything yet, honestly.
Okay. All right. That's a good place to start, because part of this conversation is to kind of give some people a lens into the experience of being a free agent as a Major League Baseball player, because we can make fun of you for being unemployed, but this is not exactly the situation. Your resume is whatever baseball website of choice, whether that is, you know, your Baseball Reference, your Fangraphs, Baseball Savant, and so on. But we kind of we're curious about this. This is not the first time you've gone through free agency, so you kind of know a little bit what to expect. Mm-hmm. But here's one way to frame it. Is you kind of already got to it, that like you have no idea, nothing's started yet. But as you reflect back on your first time through free agency, you got to give people a lens into what this experience is like. How many days a week, you know, during the offseason when you're a free agent, are you like actively doing things related to free agency, whether that's communicating with your agent, whether that's meeting with teams, whether that's, I mean, I guess, you know, working out,
like calling someone, you know, who lives in a place, like,
yeah.
How many days a week are you doing free agency actively?
It's not so like rigid like that. It's more fluid. I think it can go so many different directions. Like, I know I've played with guys where they had their agent, but like they almost would go over their agent and like do their own contract and like their own thing. I have no desire to do that. You know, you guys know I'm with Ryan. I've been with him since I was a teenager, more so than him just being my agent. He's also one of my best friends. And so I put my full trust into him and like CAA and everything they're doing. I don't get involved in any way whatsoever. I let them do their job, talking to the front offices and setting up meetings. And then when it's time for me to have a Zoom meeting or meet a manager or pitching coach for lunch or whatever that may be, then I'm ready for that. But as far as like my off season, it's like the same as any other off season when it comes to like the like work and preparation for the season.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know where that season's going to be yet.
When you do the Zoom calls, like, what do you wear? Like, you just like, you would wear something a little nicer than that, or you would.
No, it depends on the timing. Like, we're doing this podcast in the morning. I'm going to go work out after this. So I'm wearing my workout clothes. If I had a Zoom call with like the Detroit Tigers or the Rakuten Monkeys or, you know, the Seoul Swallows, whatever.
Yeah, that's a team for sure.
I would probably just wear whatever.
Okay. You wouldn't like suit up. You wouldn't like suit up like a job interview.
No, I don't. I don't, because I don't think it's not a. it's not a traditional job interview. It's so different. It's so different.
And this
is it more like, wait, is it more like a first date than a job interview?
It's like the team is pitching you.
Right. It goes both ways. It goes both ways, right? You obviously want to be impressive, but they are also trying to make you feel like that's somewhere where you would want to go.
Yes.
So it's going both ways. That's why you're kind of interviewing each other. And I think that's kind of what Jake's getting at. And it was that something that you kind of learned last time when you went through this?
Yeah. I mean, I think I only had like one Zoom call, and that was with the Red Sox. And I had like one lunch with another team. My free agency.
Who paid?
Oh, God. I'm pretty sure that they paid.
They paid.
And both were very nice. Good conversation. My thing is, like, when I go into this thing, I don't want to like suit up because that's not my personality. You know, I want to be myself.
That'd be so
and
misleading.
Show, like, if I were to, you know, if I'm talking to the manager, I'm talking to the GM, I'm talking to the pitching staff, like, I want to be myself. And then if you like me for myself, great. It might be a good fit.
You know. So that sounds like a first date.
I guess
that
so.
Part of it, right?
Maybe there's some of that type of vibe in there. But to me, it's more like it's a pitch meeting. Like, they're pitching you and you're just kind of like taking it all in and asking questions, you know?
Is it fun being a free agent? Like, I know this is your second time. Like, do you enjoy it? Is it cool having people be like, you're great, we love everything about you, versus say like arbitration where it's like, you suck. Like, like, we don't want to pay you anything.
I think you're going to get different answers based on who you're asking.
Yeah.
Like, if you ask Dylan Cease if free agency is fun, I'm sure he's going to say, yeah, it was a blast. I made over $200 million.
And I was done by Thanksgiving.
And it was, right? like yeah, I'm sure that in his case, it was like, Toronto was interested early, and they went and were like, all right, this is our number. And Toronto was probably like, all right, we see your number. Here's our number. It's our final offer. We're going to pull it in 10 days. And they took it because it's a load of money, right? That's my assumption. I didn't talk to him. Right. I have no idea how his free agency went. My free agency, my first one, didn't go like that at all. I down my leg the last 2 months of the season and ruined my numbers. So my value
playing for five different teams.
Yeah. So my value completely tanked going into free agency. I was lucky enough to get with the Red Sox, and you know, I really loved and cherished my experience there, despite the fact that as soon as I got there, I blew my elbow out. So that sucked. But then last year had a really, really fun time, and it was great, and we made the playoffs. And then I got hurt again, and it was like the worst thing that could have ever happened.
So I hate to bring up sad times, but I do want to ask you about that, because I saw you. Mm-hmm. During that time, and like in that moment, right? Like, it's raw, both physically and emotionally.
Yeah.
But like, when you look back on that, like, how do you take in that experience of watching the team that you had spent the whole year with compete in the biggest games of the season, and you're just like this helpless husk, like sitting there as a spectator?
Yeah, it brought me like directly back to the year prior, right? When I was rehabbing my elbow. The rehab was tough. You know, it was way tougher than my first Tommy John. You know, I'm also a lot older. So I go through that, and it's like finally when I get the chance to play again and do what I love to do, I was really, really trying to cherish it. You know, I came out of the gate kind of screwed up, and then we fixed it, and then I pitched very well, and there was a lot of fun, you know, being in that rotation and being able to follow up Crochet and how special of a season he was having, and yeah, it was a ton of fun. And then it's like, all right, cool, we're like going to make the playoffs. And then September, especially the last couple weeks of September, it was like, oh boy, this does not feel good. And yeah, it just brought me directly back to the year prior, which I thought was in the rearview mirror. You know, I'm like, all right, yeah, cool, we're past this. Everything's good now. Whether I pitch well or pitch poorly, like at least I'm healthy and pitching and contributing. And then it was just like ripped from me right at the end. You know, it was terrible. And you know what the craziest part about it is I'm completely fine now. Like I was yesterday I was playing catch at 180 feet and spinning breaking balls, and I feel great. I'm getting really good work done. So it's like, all it did was take me out of pitching in the playoffs and screw over my free agency. That's all that happened.
from an optics side. Now it's a little bit different than, you know, multiple months of poor performance. And that's the other thing, as we kind of reflect on the differences between round two of free agency for you and last time. You did, I imagine, still feel better about what you were able to do this year compared to what you were able to do last year, you know, sour ending aside. I think, is that fair to say?
You're coming off, like, you feel better about your walk here now than you did the last time around.
I do, but I still have this kind of bitter taste in my mouth from the end of it. And, you know, not being able to go in the playoffs is like inexcusable in my book. It's just, unfortunately, my elbow was stuck. Like, well, you can't see in the camera, but my elbow was stuck. I couldn't move it very much. It's like, how am I going to go and throw a baseball right now? So, I don't know. I wish we had made it further. I wish, you know, we had somehow managed to win that game three and make it further, because I think I could have rehabbed back and been ready at some point if we kept climbing up through the playoffs. But
do you watch the playoffs after you get knocked out?
Yeah, I watched.
Or is it just like,
I watched.
Okay. Because some guys, it's just like, I don't want to engage with this.
Yeah, like, no, I watched. I thought it was a very exciting playoffs, especially the World Series. It was really cool.
I want to ask about like the 2025 Red Sox as this character, because like for us from the outside, when we're not in the room, I'm not around the team every day. You know, I was living in New York, now I'm in D.C. You guys were a reality TV show from the outside, right? There was like a lot of chaos. There was drama. There was all these things going on. When you're in it, do you feel that?
No.
Or is that narrative just like this outside contrivance?
I think that's just how it is in general. Like with any narrative, you know, I've seen some stuff online about like the Mets, and it's like, you know, it can be a fun read and like fun to like discuss on the internet, but none of it is like a reality TV show. None of it is actually
everything is
like
smaller,
that.
Everything is smaller than it is.
Everything is smaller in reality. Yes. You know, Rafi Devers, was always a joy to be around. And never, I don't think that he ever, at least from what I noticed, he never like let any of his own personal frustrations with what was going on like leak out. And like,
yeah,
he was never like being an asshole to anybody or anything like that. Like he was always a great teammate in my book. And, you know, I've been hearing more of the same from when he went over to San Francisco as well. I think that he had some of his own personal frustrations and, you know, disagreements that led to, you know, where it went. But
that's like, that crap doesn't influence your day to day when you're on the team. Like you're still waking up doing your work and playing
yeah,
the baseball game.
Yeah. Like it was a weird day when he got traded. We were on a plane and we're like on the tarmac. And usually like you get onto the charter jet and it's like, all right, here we go. But like we're sitting there for a while. And guys are wondering like, oh, is there like a mechanical issue? What's going on? And then people start talking, oh, I think there's a trade going down, whatever. And then we found out it was Rafi and it was like, whoa, what?
Was he on the plane? Or like he hadn't gotten on the plane yet?
He was like on the plane and then left the plane.
Bye, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was like, whoa, that's crazy. Again, that was like the extent of it for us. It's like, right. Damn.
You guys are like, whoa, that's crazy. Headphones on. Nap time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right. You don't have a choice. It's like, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of baseball left to play.
You have like a little bit of a conversation amongst yourselves and it's like, all right, like we're still a team here. We still got to go and win. We're going to be fine. We're going to figure it out. Moving on. That's how it is. Like guys get traded and moved and DFA'd and option and it happens all the time.
The last Red Sox thing we wanted to do before we kind of spin it forward more is just, you mentioned pitching behind Garrett Crochet in the rotation, you having the unique perspective of having seen him earlier in his career with the White Sox. I mean, talk about seeing that up close. I know he's someone that what he did in last year in 2024 with the White Sox certainly got a lot of people's attention. But when you do it with Boston after the trade, after signing the extension on a playoff team, it's a little bit different. So yeah, I mean, what was the perspective watching it up close? Did anything, was it like validation? Like, oh, I knew it could do this, or was it like, I did not see this coming?
Well, I knew everybody knew he had the tools, like the physical tools and everything like that. I think what I was most impressed with was the growth and maturity. And it was, you know, over a short period of time, over a few years. You know, when he first came up, he was like 20 years old, 21, didn't pitch in the minor leagues at all. And I saw a lot of my younger self when I first entered the Nationals clubhouse, kittens running around back there. And it was like not wanting to like, you know, say anything wrong or do anything and just kind of like, you know, be like a shadow. Right. And
well, because you guys also, you had some big personalities on that staff in Chicago with you and Carlos and Cease, like Keuchel, if I was a little guy, like if Lance I was Lynn? A kid walking into that room,
Lance Lynn, yeah,
I would be intimidated by that. Not that you guys did anything wrong, but like that's a lot, like not just veteranship. That's like like five big personalities.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd argue when I first came up, I was even worse than he was. I was like petrified when I was, you know, 21 and I got called up to the big leagues. The big difference between me and him was when I got called up, I was petrified and I sucked. He was disgusting. Like we put him in the bullpen, right? He's throwing 102 miles an hour, crazy leg kick, like wacky delivery. And it was like everybody, we're looking at each other in the dugout like, holy shit. And then, you know, he dealt with some injuries. He had the Tommy John, he had whatever else. He's kind of pushing through injuries. And I remember he would always say like, I want to be a starting pitcher. I should be a starting pitcher. And I think he would kind of butt heads with the White Sox about that, if I'm not mistaken, here and there. And then he finally got the opportunity and it was like, he never looked back. It was like, yep, this is what I do. I'm one of the best in the world. And, the work ethic speaks for itself. Like he's always worked very hard, very focused. He's one of those guys where it's like baseball. You know what I mean? Baseball. That's it. And it really works in his favor. I mean, you see just, again, I knew him when he was young and then we reconnected. He comes over in the trade, signs the extension, and immediately he's like the leader. He immediately became the leader. One of, if not like the leader in the clubhouse, along with like Bregman and whoever else on the position player side, he became the leader and led very well, not only through example, but vocally. I'm like, who is this guy? This is incredible. and he's hilarious. He's super funny. You know, I'll glaze them for another 20 minutes. How long do you want me to go for here? You know, it's
no, like, you're good. This is, you honestly, you set up, and again, that insight is awesome. And I think, right, that transformation is not something that everyone totally understood, because as far as a lot of the other Red Sox were concerned, it's just like, this all-star pitcher that showed up and is really good, and that's now he's on our team, and that's really cool. But you were like, no, no, no.
It goes beyond that. It goes beyond that. He's worth every single penny. He's worth way more than his extension. He's worth so much more than that. But it makes sense. I get it. I get why you totally do that extension.
But let's spin this back to you, because you mentioned what you used to be like, right? And a lot's happened since those days with the Nationals, since even more recently, the last time we had you on the podcast 5-6 years ago or whatever. What is, when did you start to feel like, all right, I'm good, I know what I'm doing? And have we now reached the point where you feel like the old guy, where you feel like you're just full?
Are you unk?
Are you full unk status at this point? Or
are you unk, Lucas?
Or are you still working in that direction?
I don't think I'm unk, because I'm too tuned into
you're too,
too Bombardio Crocodillo. You're too memed up.
Yeah, I'm too into memes and bull ass internet culture and stuff that Gen Z's into.
But in the clubhouse, relative to the baseball, in the context of baseball. And what you feel like, because you were the hotshot youngster. Now now you're just old man Lucas.
Yeah, no, you know, I'm definitely old. I just don't. I don't know if I see myself as when I think of guys that I considered my vets, unk vets. I think James Shields. I think Lance Lynn, and I can't put myself in their category, at least maybe one day, but not yet. How much they accomplished and their presence in a clubhouse. I can't say that I bring that to the table. I think that, I definitely am myself a lot more within the context of the clubhouse. I'm myself. And I feel comfortable being myself more so than I ever have in my career. But that's just because I've been doing it for so long. I don't give a shit more about what people think.
To your point, though, I think part of that is also you still feel like there's a lot more to accomplish. You're still in the middle of the prime of your career. And I imagine that there's still things that you feel like you can improve upon and that you want to get better at and improve on the field. Forget whatever.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I feel like I have to split my career into two halves with the surgery kind of in the middle. Because I had a prime of my career in my mid-20s, and now I'm looking to have the second prime of my career in my early 30s. I feel really good about it too. I think last year had its ups and downs, obviously with having to deal with injury. And, having to completely fix my arm slot mechanics after I came back from surgery, I was so screwed up to where now this is my first normal off season in a couple years. And I'm able to get really good work done. I told you guys I moved down here to Florida, the great state of Florida. And
is your license Florida?
Yeah. Everything. Oh. All yeah, right. I've been a Florida resident since I've been living here last offseason when I was rehabbing in
Florida, man.
Yeah. I was rehabbing in Fort Myers, then now I'm on the other side. And I feel like there's so much to prove. For me personally, at this point in my career, it's not about chasing a bag, it's about chasing a ring. I just want to win in the playoffs. I've only had these tiny little tastes of playoff baseball to where it's that can't be it. I really want to win. So that's a huge thing I prioritize, when it comes to free agency and you have a choice. It's okay, where can I fit in? Where can I fit in well in a club that has a winning culture and is prepared to win in the playoffs? I hopefully I get that opportunity. But what I'm looking forward to is this second prime of my career. Last year I was able to kind of tap into that for I don't know, like a 2 month span. I was kind of doing what I like to do at a high level before kind of trailed off in September. And so, you know, now it's like, all right, let's get prepared. Let's get locked in and enter that second prime and really help a club win and win at the highest level. That's what I'm really interested in doing.
So I want to ask about the playoffs because you've appeared twice. You've had
one good one,
one
bad one.
You were nails in front of nobody against the A's in the wild card series. Okay. And you were ass in front of a couple people in game two against the Astros in 2021. So like when you look back on those, the dude who started those games is just like not who you are anymore. And it's just like a completely different world. But what do you like having the taste of that experience? And just knowing, but not under, not like fully getting it, not fully living that, like not going deep. Does that really actually change the way that you approach your career moving forward in a way where like, maybe if you hadn't had those experiences?
I'm so jealous of guys that are just in the playoffs every year. Like the dog guys on the Dodgers.
Did you talk to Bregman about that? Did you talk to Bregman about that?
Like, he's never not been in the playoffs.
I don't think I had any like conversations with him about that really. It's just like, just the way my career is, you know, two of my best friends that went to high school, they both have World Series rings, right? Like, and I'm over here. I've never made it out the freaking first round. It's like, damn, bro. You know, I got to be better. That's it. I just got to be better.
I think partially genuinely, partially somewhat self-deprecatingly, you got to be better. You got to be better. What has to be better, right? What is important for the next step for you to access your prime? Because I had so much fun watching you pitch this year because it was just like, well, Lucas is back. I enjoyed watching Lucas do his thing, and he wasn't doing it for a long time before this. But, you know, if you just look at the pitch mix, you're like, okay, it's not that different. You know, what's, but I know that there's, you know, we don't have to go too nerdy here, but what if you can kind of zero in on some things that you are most focused on, like we got to figure this out. If I am going to have this next prime, what are those things?
I mean, I can go super nerdy.
I know you're capable of. Yeah, I know you're capable of it.
I'd like to miss bats more than I did last year. It felt like a weird anomaly that I wasn't missing bats as much as I should have been. But when you actually break it down, it makes sense. The command. Like my heater, when I've had my best like swing and miss rates and strikeout rates, my heater, I do a very good job of keeping it in the upper third of the strike zone to lefties and righties and pitching inside to lefties and righties, like hammering the up and in quadrant to both of them, right? Last year, my heater was a little bit more erratic. There was a lot of like miss to the middle, a lot of like pulling away, which kind of get, I don't know, it doesn't create that the tunnels you want to create, especially with the changeup. So just getting in a good kind of like mechanical flow to where like you can just stick that heater at the top, I think solves a lot of the problems. Just kind of letting everything else play off of it. The changeup and the slider both feel pretty good. The curveball is actually a very good pitch that I have when it comes to its metrics and whatnot. It's just I haven't thrown it for strikes enough. I think the biggest thing, if you were to like really simplify it, it's like throw more strikes and throw quality strikes in the areas that I want to where like we want to execute them. And then it should lead to getting back to where we need to be with like the whiff rate and all that.
How has your self-evaluation process changed since the beginning? I mean, maybe not even, you know, way back with the Nationals, but how different is what you look at? Obviously, I'm sure you have more information at your disposal now than you did 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago. But even when you were doing great with the White Sox, like how different is what you're looking at now? Because from the outside, it's for us, as I mentioned, right? Okay, great. I could pull up your Savant page and be like, damn, the colors are blue. He's bad. Or the colors are red. He's doing this well, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how we do it. I'm sure you look at some of the same stuff, but a little bit more specifically. But yeah, is it that different or are you still mostly looking at the same things that you always have?
I look at like true media and like heat maps. It's like, where am I throwing these pitches? where's the damage being done? Oh yeah, no shit. The damage is like middle across. Okay. So let's throw the heater up here. Yeah, it's like we got to be better at throwing the heater up here, and then we can stick that down and away one if we want. But at the same time, like, stuff is a factor too. Like, when my body felt good last year, I was throwing 96. When my body felt bad, I was throwing 91, 92. So it's like, okay, let's work to get the body moving well and feeling good for a longer, more extended period of time. And hopefully I can throw a little bit faster. Velocity is important on everything. You know, if I'm throwing my heater 95, but I still throw my changeup 81, that's a very good speed difference. But if the fastball's 91 and the changeup's 81, that's not as good of a speed difference. So there's kind of a lot of things that go into play, but it is, at least for me, better to keep it more simple. I'd say an example of like something that's way different that I'll look at now than probably didn't even exist 5-10 years ago to the same extent is the biomechanics stuff. Last season I was like, my arm slot does not feel right. I feel like I'm throwing sidearm. And we got to do a whole breakdown, and they spit back the Red Sox, like, you know, did the biomechanics breakdown. It spit back at me like, you get to see yourself as a skeleton. Not, it used to be stick figures, but now it's a full on skeleton. You're seeing a 3D render model skeleton going through a pitching motion. And I got to see the good skeleton and the bad skeleton. The bad skeleton is how I was throwing in the beginning of 2025. And the good skeleton was kind of like they do this combination of all of your best. I don't know how to explain it. Like they create this like mean, or they create this average of all of your best bolts. And that skeleton mechanics was different than the bad one. And it's like, what's different? Oh, look at how I'm tilting my shoulders. Look how my hips are just moving in flat. Like, what the hell am I doing? So I looked at the skeletons.
It's so subtle.
10 years ago, you just had to feel that out with trial and error, or have like an unbelievable pitching coach.
And you watch a video, you'd be in the video room. Oh my God, we'd be in the video room for hours, like looking at this side angle and the back angle and this and that, which is still like, I still like to look at video, but especially hitters, like they have their bat and then they're just on the iPad, like looking at their swing from the, you know, open first base side, third base side. Everyone still likes to look at video, but I thought the skeletons was just next level. That was awesome. And I saw it and I'm like, if these are both my right hand, like my release point was like good. And then like, I was down here somewhere. It was like, dude, like, oh, what am I doing? I knew I was throwing sidearm. I felt it. And so we just pinpointed a couple parts of the mechanics where it was like, oh, we should be able to change this relatively quickly. My hip tilt, my shoulder tilt, whatever. And then boom, I got back on top. And that's when I kind of started that run that I had that was pretty solid.
Because it's not as simple as, oh, you're throwing at a 50 degree angle. Just put it a little higher, right? It is not.
Maybe for some guys
arm,
it is.
Some guys it is, but like, I guess what I'm trying to explain to the listeners is like, somewhere in the biomechanical chain of you moving, like something's out of whack, and it's not always the arm, right? It could be, and that's what we on the public side don't get, right? Like I can look at a chart of your average release points, and I can, right now, I have it right in front of me, right? Like your average release point in May was 50 degrees, and in July it was 54 because you fixed it. But like, I don't know the how or the why or the what gets you to that point. And like, that's the super cool gap between what us nerds are working with and what teams and players are working with.
Yeah, but I mean, the teams and the players have a bunch of nerds to help with that.
The best nerds.
Yeah. Yeah. So
the top nerds.
So, yeah, I mean, it's different for everybody. There might be guys that like look at the skeleton. They're like, oh, 54 degrees. Okay. Dick, dick, dick. Beep, boop, beep, boop. And then like they just go and throw and like they're like, oh, yeah, okay, I got 54 degrees. For me to get to 54 degrees, I don't know what the ideal degrees is. I just knew it had to be higher than where I was. To get to the ideal, I knew that I needed to fix my shoulder tilt and my hip tilt. I had to stay on my backside longer. And yeah, it just worked out.
Lucas, my last question for you is this. Obviously, you want to play baseball for more time, and you will do so. But like, you're pseudo unk now. Like, you're in your 30s, just like us. Where do you see yourself in 10 years? Like, when you're done, which...
Oh, you know what I want to do so bad? And they might not let me do it.
Who's they? Dude, this is after you're... No one can tell you what to do.
Who's they?
No, they can.
Uh-oh.
When MLB doesn't want me anymore, I don't see myself doing the thing that I've seen guys do where they like go and play in AAA and like, no. I'm like, cool. I'm done. I'm not good enough. Whether I'm too battered and hurt or I'm not good enough anymore or whatever, I'm too old, whatever it might be. I want to play a season in Japan so bad. Now, the only issue with that is from what I'm hearing, the Japanese, the Nippon League, correct? When it comes to like signing the international player, especially if you're getting international pitcher, they really value velocity. And I don't know if when I'm 39, 40 years old, if I'm going to have any velocity. So I don't know if they'll even want me.
Hey, not with that attitude, you won't. Come on now. And listen.
It'd be funny. It's like I finish up whatever my last contract is in baseball. It's like, all right, I can't do this anymore here. But then I just go crazy training for like a full year. And I
just below.
I start throwing 98 and then I go close games for the
the Buffaloes. Yeah.
Yeah. The Buffaloes or the Giants or whoever.
Yeah.
What's funny about this is like back in the day, that's really what it was. Like the type of player going to play NPB was more like, I'm at the end of my career. I played 5 to 10 in the bigs. I'm going to go play in Japan. That's not really what it is anymore.
There's like a whole movie about that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Now it's like you're a quad A starter and you could sign a split deal or you could go to Round Rock or you could go get a mil from a team in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the last time, Jordan, that like, I guess Adam Jones,
I think, was the last guy that did like the retirement tour Japan thing.
I think you should talk to Adam Jones in about 5 years. Check in with Adam Jones in 5 years. He's love this Oryx for you.
Hook up.
I love this for you. This is a great, great way to finish it up.
It's just, I don't know, because I was talking to Ryan, my agent, about it, and he's like, I don't know, bro. Like, they want velocity. I'm like, am I going to have velocity when I'm 40, you know, whatever age that they kick me out of here?
Lucas, before we let you go, is there anything you want to plug? You know, often when we have writers or other people on, we, you know, where can we find your work? Anything you want to shout out before we can kick you off of here?
For all the major league teams listening, where can they find you?
Besides Ryan,
you can find me running night raids on Blue Gate.
Okay, there you go.
Those are words like I don't understand. 8
people that know what you're talking about.
There's probably a good amount of people that know what I'm talking about. It's a video game reference.
We're well aware of.
All right,
but Lucas, again, for the major league teams listening, Lucas is like getting ready to like pitch in 2026 also, in addition to
doing night raids on Blue Gate.
You think that like MLB's like front office executives are going to listen to this? Like, ooh,
what is we're going to find out. There's only one way to find out.
I would say that nobody with enough influence to make a signing will listen to this. However, non-zero number of people that can recommend a signing are 100% listening to this.
Great. So and now every single person is like, please don't sign this jackass.
100,000%. Lucas Giolito, thank you for the time. It is always a pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
To speak with you.
It's the best. So fun.
Appreciate you, man.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's go around the world and around the league. Three pitchers have signed contracts with baseball teams that did not last year play in America, that are Americans. Good sentence, Jake. I think that was very straightforward and coherent.
Yeah, we got a trio of signings here that are all, I guess, connected. And it does make me wonder if that's not a coincidence. I do know that the team players that are that play overseas, whether it's in KBO or NPB, when they finish their season, like their teams kind of want to know, like, you coming back or not? You know, like if you're the Hanwha Eagles and you've got KBO MVP Cody Ponce and also a really good number two in Ryan Weiss, who we'll talk about in a second. You kind of want to know if those guys are coming back or not. And so I don't know if there's like a formal deadline to like decide, hey, are you coming back or are you going to go back to MLB? But here we have three pitchers who pitched in Asian leagues last year. Cody Ponce signing with the Blue Jays, Ryan Weiss signing with the Astros, and Anthony Kay, left-hander, signing with the White Sox. All, you know, agreeing to deals here in a very short span of time. So we'll lump them together. Let's start with Cody Ponce because 3 years and $30 million is not a small contract.
No, it is not. He is the, from a success perspective, the best of this trio. He was the MVP last year in Korea, came up with the Pirates and the Brewers, and just didn't really have the stuff to succeed at the big league level. Went over to Korea, kind of remade his body, got in really good shape, and just started throwing a lot harder. Anthony Kay is a slightly different story. Like for him, it's more, he's a lefty and he was like, mid to low 90s, he just never got enough run in the big leagues with the Mets or the
Cubs, Blue Jays. Like, I mean, it was Blue Jays mostly.
Blue Jays. Bouncing around. Like, he just didn't get enough run to really prove that his stuff was going to work at the big league level. Former first-round pick, goes over to Japan, plays for the Bay Stars, and just succeeds with his stuff and shows that he can command it at the point where teams are now interested in bringing him back.
Now, Ponce is interesting, too, because he was in Japan for 3 years before he went to Korea and was, like, fine, pitching for a couple different teams in NPB. But, I mean, yeah, the season he just had in KBO is, I mean, like, we've seen some good seasons for guys in that league that have come back. But he, I think, have set a strikeout record. Like, it was dominance that we have not seen in quite some time. And the velocity especially plays in that league even more so than it does in Japan, where it's a little bit more common. But 3 years and $30 million on one hand is a massive commitment for a pitcher with this little of a major league track record. For the Toronto Blue Jays, who are throwing cash around and clearly are about to pay Jose Berríos to either not pitch for their team or I don't know what they're doing with Jose Berríos. They don't really like $10 million a year is nothing. Like that is a layup if this dude can come over and be a competent number four. And if they do feel like there's more upside, that's a hell of a signing. So I think to say it's easy to be like, oh, no risk at all. It's like, well, the risk is that you really are counting on him to be in your rotation and he's got to prove that he can get big leaguers out, which has not happened. But yeah, I mean, for Toronto to end up to emerge a team that has already signed Dylan Cease, you know, you look at the, you look around and you say, oh, well, you, couldn't you see a lot of other teams that need rotation help that could maybe use Cody Ponce for $10 million a year? And the Jays are like, nah, sorry. We're still, shopping.
This is what I said the other day is like, the Cease deal made me feel better about Bo Bichette staying with the Blue Jays.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And the Ponce deal, even though they're spending more money, like it makes me feel even better. Yeah. Because the Jays are clearly in it. Like they're in it to spend and they're in it to win it. And like, that's great stuff. Mm-hmm. Anthony Kay and Ryan Weiss, mm-hmm. I have less to say.
Yeah. Just
as it relates to them. The one thing I will say, big picture, really about all three of these guys, mm-hmm. is often when players like this, players that have never been on the radar of most fans, go over to Asia, often the majority of ball carers in America just like forget about, like they just never existed. And so for these players to come back and be something, to rejuvenate themselves in their careers is amazing, right? I think in our sporting culture, the idea of like get ready to learn KBO is like detrimental and is like a career death sentence at times. And I know these are not the first guys to come back, but we're seeing more and more, and I think we'll continue to see more and more as, you know, the years fly by.
And that's a good place to kind of wrap this combo, because, right, K to the White Sox, I mean, good. Like, he's going to get a chance to be in the rotation. Maybe they trade him. Maybe he's still there next year. Awesome. Ryan Weiss is important just because nobody had heard of him because he's never been to the majors. Then again, you know who else hadn't been to the majors when he came back from KBO? Merrill Kelly. And now here he is as an actual free agent at age 37 after proving himself as a mid-rotation starter in the big leagues for multiple years. Is Ryan Weiss going to be that? I don't know. But the Astros are pretty good with guys like this. So it would not be surprising if they can kind of coax a solid back-end starter out of him. And he's the youngest of the bunch, too. He's only 28. So, Jake, we have one more bit of news before we get to Good, Bad, Ugla. And that's that the Rockies have a general manager. Oh, my goodness. We know that Paul D. Podesta will be the Pobo in Denver. Still a hilarious, amazing sentence. But it was pretty clear that Di Podesta was going to try and get some help running a major league team since he hasn't been in baseball in a decade. He brings in Josh Burns, who certainly has experience running a team, although it has been quite some time since Josh Burns was in charge of a major league team. He has a pretty lengthy resume in terms of being in major league front offices. He has been with the Dodgers for, I think, over a decade now.
11 years.
Yeah. So that's been in more of, I think, like a assistant GM, special assistant. We know he's been heavily involved in the draft. But he was a GM in San Diego. He was a GM in Arizona. He did work for the Rockies much earlier in his career, I believe, from 2000 to 2002. So very well versed. This is someone that we actually got a chance to chat with a little bit at the World Series as he was around the Dodgers. And I mean,
DC guy,
right? So we have some cool personal connections there. I think what's encouraging about this is that Josh Burns has been around winning a lot at many stops along his way. And while he has not necessarily been in charge, and while he maybe doesn't represent like the new age direction that we maybe ascribe to whatever group of people, 35-year-olds that like the Washington Nationals are assembling to like bring the Nationals into the new baseball world, he is someone that I think has been around a lot of the right people for a long time and clearly has the leadership qualities and direction to fit this role in a very real way. That makes a lot of sense.
I am just happy the Rockies hired a person that worked for a different Major League Baseball team.
Yeah, that's another.
It's really that simple.
Yeah.
So I went through their media guide and there were 9 people that started 2025 at the director level or higher for the Rockies. The average amount of years that those 9 people had spent with the organization was 26 years. Okay. 4 of them were over 30. That level of continuity is not continuity. That's staleness, right? That's calcification. That is not doing anything and not getting new ideas. And so is Josh Burns, like this new hotshot, Toboni, you know, clean shaven, looks like he could still play college ball type cat. No, he's not. but he has been around the Los Angeles Dodgers for the last 11 years. And to be honest with you, that's enough for me.
Dude, if you're the Rockies, how do we get to anything resembling that? Well, Josh Burns at least has some idea. That doesn't mean that the Rockies are still not light years away from contention because of how many things that are going to have to go right for them to be good anytime soon. But I think we like
this. I'll say this. Josh Burns, one, is smart, and two, knows what it looks like to be good at building a baseball team in 2025. Can he do that is a different question, but he certainly has some of the attributes you need. And that alone, maybe the bar is the floor here for the Colorado Rockies, but at least it's not subterranean. Okay.
The bar is 119 losses. All right, let's finish up. I know you're listening to this on a Thursday, but in the offseason, the days of the week don't matter as much. Good, bad, ugly is good, bad, ugly. And it is time to do it once again. Let's get into it. Something good, something bad, something ugly from the week that was. Jake Mintz, start us off.
Much like us, Craig Stammen, the new manager of the San Diego Padres, is going to be, has been, in the Dominican Republic this week. Jordan and I, by the time you're listening to this, are probably in the air on our way to Santiago for a weekend of Lidom watching. We are incredibly excited about that. We'll be probably posting a bunch on the Twitter machine and the Instagram machine if you want to follow our journeys, our adventures down in DR. But I think it is good. Craig Stammen, the new skipper for those Padres, went down to the DR, went to a Lidom game to basically just like say hello to Luis Campusano, who was really like the third string catcher.
Cannot believe Campusano's even still on the roster, and I kind of still doubt he will be by the time we get to opening day.
Now, I would imagine went down there probably to say hello to other members of the Padres that live in the Dominican Republic, namely Fernando Tatis Jr. But I just love that Craig Stammen is out there grinding, building these relationships so much that he's doing in-game interviews with the Lisa broadcast.
You know, I watched this conversation. He definitely mentioned Tatis. He mentioned Machado. I think he mentioned one other person. You know who he didn't mention that I hope he made time for is our guy, Randy Vasquez. Now, I don't know if Randy Vasquez is in his native Dominican during the offseason, but I feel like Randy Vasquez is still more likely to be a part of their plans than Luis Campusano. But either way, maybe Craig Stammen will still be down there when we are down there this weekend. And if we see him, we will be sure to say hello.
I also love that he does this whole interview speaking in English, but all the questions are in Spanish.
Yeah. He gets the questions that he's, but again, that's another thing. I'm sure he's brushing up. My good this week also involves international travel. And that is just this very wholesome clip of Giancarlo Stanton at a play ball event in Colombia. This is just a clip on MLB social channels. Play ball, of course, you know, the initiative that MLB has where they just go run clinics and camps in different parts of the world and country, just have kids play baseball. Very simple premise. I don't know. I don't really know why or care why Giancarlo Stanton spent time out of his offseason to do this in Colombia, whether he was just already in the area or if MLB paid him to go down to do this, or I don't care. This is awesome. It's very basic big leaguers, you know, interacting with kids playing baseball. But like, I don't know. Giancarlo is the coolest. And like, what an awesome thing for him to just show up in Colombia, which is not down the street, and just, you know, hit some wiffle balls with some kids. It just made me happy. I just loved it.
It's also a particularly honest group of kids, I think, is what makes the video.
Yes, there's a couple of great clips, which you guys can, I won't spoil those, but I don't know. Giancarlo's just awesome, man. Like, he's so great. So that made me happy. Very simple, good. What's your bad?
Anthony Rendon, Everything about it is bad.
Yeah.
It's all bad. It's all bad. We got this news last week from Alden Gonzalez of ESPN that the Angels and third baseman Anthony Rendon are in talks about buying out the final year of his contract, potentially bringing a resolution to the seven-year, $245 million albatross, I mean, deal that did not come close to paying dividends for the team, a source told ESPN on Wednesday. Few baseball players make me mad by how they conduct themselves. And Anthony Rendon really pisses me off, man, sometimes to think about. I understand the injuries have sidelined him. I understand that he doesn't owe me anything. I understand that he earned what he is being paid by his performance at the beginning of his career. However, there's just a way that he has kind of carried himself through all this, through the injuries, through the lack of availability, that like feels disrespectful to the fans in Anaheim. Like, fans are not taxpayers, and in the way that, like, you know, we pay money to the government for goods, like for services and for the roads. But in a way, fans are, right? Like, every dollar an Angels fan is spending on a hot dog, like, some tiny little percentage of that is going to Anthony Rendon. And I think that most players, if they don't appreciate that dynamic, they at least pretend to. And Rendon's consistent disregard and disrespect and lack of like forthright honesty regarding his status has just made this entire thing a sham and legitimately like sullies his reputation, in my mind, as a guy who just doesn't care. And that's a bummer because, boy, when Anthony Rendon was cooking, what a ball player he was, man. What a ball player he was. And it's just a shame. Wow. The whole thing's a shame.
How did he get this contract? Like, well, okay. Watch him in 2019. You'd want to pay him also, but did not work out.
I don't know. Like, comparing him to Chris Bryant, like, Chris Bryant seems like he feels bad. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm misreading this. But, like, no, he's pretending a level of contrition.
Yes. We have, at this point, I think we've got a pretty substantial amount of evidence that does not paint Rendon in a particularly positive light. So it is a shame for many reasons. My bad is also Angels related, but I'm not really just going to make this about the Angels. The Angels signed Alek Manoah. And whether that itself is bad, will it be bad? Will he be bad? Are the Angels bad? It's not really about that. It's just one of those things where you'd be like, oh man, Alek Manoah, and you just pull up the baseball reference page and you're just like, man, where did this, what happened here? And there are some simple answers to that, which is that he got hurt and got surgery and hasn't been the same since he got back. But, oh, I mean, this was, talk about like a shooting star situation. Third in the Cy Young in 2022 and just terrible and not pitching ever since. He did come back for the Blue Jays this year very quietly in AAA and was throwing 91. And the Braves like claimed him on waivers for 5 days and then non-tendered him, very strange sequence. And now the Angels, too. I mean, him getting a major league deal, maybe he's not guaranteed to be in the rotation, but is kind of shocking. It is pretty on brand for the Angels to just be like, yeah, screw it. We'll bet on the guy that he existed however many years ago. I'm wishing the best for him. He's very fun to watch pitch when he was good. But boy, does 2022 feel like a whole lot more than 3 or 4 years ago at this point. And so my bad is, yeah, it's just like, oh, ah, God, that sucks. like it's like the fact that he's still trying, I'm glad and I hope it works out. But man, we really got to this point and that bums me out in a totally different way. So Angels fans, thanks for listening. Let's go to Ugla.
You go.
All right, I'll go first. This is very simple. The Mets, SNY Mets Twitter account posted a photo courtesy of the Instagram account of a trainer by the name of, I believe it is Emmy or Enyi Capayan, who was a trainer, I think based in Florida, or maybe in DR. I think maybe both. And it is a photo, SNY Mets. It says, Carlos Mendoza visits with Juan Soto during his offseason training. And it's his trainer and Carlos Mendoza and Juan Soto. And Soto's looking really jacked. And just everyone's responding like about Soto. Wow, Soto's going to hit 60 homers. Oh, man, Soto, Mendoza. Oh, fire Mendoza, whatever. It's a Mets account. And I saw this and I was like, I'm sorry. What is this shirt that this trainer is wearing?
I saw this, too.
And it is a shirt of Guardians utility man Angel Martinez with a motif Angels in the outfield, Angel in the outfield. And I tracked this shirt down. It is made by a local Cleveland kind of merch company, GV Artwork, which I should go check out their store because it seems like they make some cool stuff. I just can't. This is amazing. And Angel Martinez, who seems to be like a delightful young gent, and I wish him all the success in the world moving forward as a major leaguer, was not very good this past year. Also, my favorite part about this, and really the most ugly part, is the premise of Angel in the outfield. Was never played outfield in his life until last season because he was the second baseman at shortstop. So I'd like to think that this was like kind of embracing that of like his move to the outfield. But it's just, it's as far as like merch that makes you go, what? Wow. This is way up there. And I love that all the Mets fans probably don't even know who he is.
So the Ugla thing about this shirt that you haven't mentioned that makes it even more ugly is that he looks like he's dead.
This is the other part, which is like, I know we're going with Angels in the outfield, but the wings do make it seem a little commemorative. Like, I don't know. I agree with you. That part is also pretty ugly.
There's the photo of him looking up at the sky. Like, mm-hmm.
As far as you know, Angel alive and well, doing great. And I also just love that this trainer, like, I hope he seems to have multiple clients, but his Instagram does make it look like it's just Juan Soto, Angel Martinez. Those are the guys. It's like nothing in between. So anyway, I like Angel. I hope he's great in 2026. And I might have to get this t-shirt. Ugla.
Story time. My Ugla. Jordan Schusterman. What does it say on the document under my Ugla?
It says, a gift that I got in the mail. So I don't know when
you
this happened.
You have not seen this.
I have not seen this. So show and tell time. Let's do it.
One of the highlights of our postseason experience beyond the ballpark was the discovery of a beverage establishment in the city of Toronto.
That's what they call them in Canada.
Yeah. A bar. A pub, in fact, a place called the Imperial Pub, a lovely watering hole that I stumbled upon with friend of the program, Jeff Passan, one night after the ALCS. Jordan was not yet in Toronto. Jeff, myself, and a number of other people then befriended the bartender that night, who turned out to be the grandson of the original owner of the bar. And sadly, the bar was due to close in a month's time. It had been open for 81 years. It had carpet. It had a full library upstairs. It had cheap drinks. It had a full karaoke set up in the back. And we did karaoke one night. We went most of the nights we were in Toronto. Boy, shouts out to Jacob Newman, my guy. I'm sorry that your bar closed. University bought up a lot of the property on the block. End of the story. Jacob and I, the bartender that night, he's around our age, have kept in touch. Now, Jacob, big Blue Jays fan. Okay? Blue Jays fan. He texted me a couple weeks ago and said, hey, what's your address? I want to send you something. I said, okay. He texted me, hey, I didn't put my name on it, but you'll know it was from me. So I open up the package. And what do I have?
Oh, my goodness. Is that a signed Ubaldo Jimenez jersey?
That's exactly.
Oh my God. What an ruthless, absolutely just epic burn from a Blue Jays fan who, like, what is so amazing about that, for those, of course, unfamiliar with the connection between Orioles Ubaldo Jimenez and the Toronto Blue Jays, it's like before a month ago, like that was a really important Blue Jays moment in this era of Blue Jays baseball.
Edwin Encarnacion's walk-off home run in the wild card game of 2016, also known as the Zach Britton sitting on his ass game, when he did not come in from the bullpen. That is from that. And we, Jacob, this guy and I had discussed it briefly. At no point did I think he was going to just send me a jersey of Ubaldo. And I certainly didn't think it was going to be signed. Now, here's the thing. What do I do with this? A great gift. Is it a gift? Because it's a taunt, really.
But yeah.
Like, I'm not framing this and putting it up in my office.
No, I think it's like something that you kind of stow away. Because the next point I was going to make is how, like, right.
Just for in the case?
No. For the Blue Jays, that moment has clearly been surpassed, right? For the Orioles, that moment really hasn't been, like, overcome, right? And so I think until the Orioles overcome that moment, that needs to stay away. And then at some point, in some form, I think that's when it can kind of resurface as like, all right, this is now over. Or you could view it the other way, where it has to stay out until the Orioles
it's a long can time. Like,
bury that moment. So I don't know. It's interesting. But it's a fair question. I think you've already used it in a great way. So shout out to Jacob. I can't find my, I thought I had my hat here from the pub, but I don't. So either way, we appreciate him. We appreciate all the great people in Toronto that that welcomed us for those weeks in October. We had a great time there, and I hope to be back soon. And by the way, if they keep signing good baseball players, good chance probably we'll be back there. So sounds good to me, even if that's before the postseason. So with that, that's our good, our bad, and our ugla. Thank you for listening to this Thursday edition of Baseball Barbacast. We are in Dominican Republic for this weekend. Then we head to Orlando for the winter meetings, where we will talk to you next. So everyone have a good weekend. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing, as always. Thank you to Lucas Giolito for joining us. We hope you enjoyed that insight into our unemployed friend's winter. Until next week, from the winter meetings, adios, my friends.